passing seaman, and had already realised just why Jamie was passing time in idle conversation by the rail with me. If anyone had been in doubt about Mr. Willoughby's being under Jamie's protection, they would be rapidly disabused of the notion. So you saved his life, gave him work, and keep him out of trouble, and he insults you and thinks you're an ignorant barbarian, I said dryly. Sweet little fellow. Aye, well. The wind had shifted slightly, blowing a lock of Jamie's hair free across his face. He thumbed it back behind his ear and leaned further toward me, our shoulders nearly touching.
Let him see what he likes. I'm the only one who understands him.
Really? I laid a hand over Jamie's where it rested on the rail.
Well, maybe not to say understand him, he admitted.
He looked down at the deck between his feet.
But I do remember, he said softly, what it's like to have nothing but your pride and a friend.
I remembered what Innes had said, and wondered whether it was the one-armed man who had been his friend in time of need. I knew what he meant. I had had Joe Abernethy, and knew what a difference it made. Yes, I had a friend at the hospital, I began, but was interrupted by loud exclamations of disgust emanating from under my feet.
Damn, blazing Hades, that filth-eating son of a pig fart.
I looked down, startled, then realised from the muffled Irish oaths proceeding from below that we were standing directly over the galley. The shouting was loud enough to attract attention from the hands forward, and a small group of sailors gathered with us, watching in fascination as the cook's black kerchiefed head poked out of the hatchway, glaring ferociously at the crowd.
"Burry-assed swabs," he shouted. "What are you looking at? Two of your idle bastards tumble arse down here and toss this muck over the side. Do you mean me to be climbing ladders all day and me with half a leg?"
The head disappeared abruptly, and with a good-natured shrug, Picard motioned to one of the younger sailors to come along below. Shortly there was a confusion of voices and a bumping of some large object down below, and a terrible smell assaulted my nostrils. Jesus Christ on a piece of toast! I snatched a handkerchief from my pocket and clapped it to my nose. This wasn't the first smell I had encountered afloat, and I usually kept a linen square soaked in wintergreen in my pocket as a precaution. What's that?
By the smell of it, dead horse. A very old horse at that, and a long time dead.
Jamie's long, thin nose looked a trifle pinched around the nostrils, and all around sailors were gagging, holding their noses, and generally commenting unfavourably on the smell. Maitland and Grossman, faces averted from their burden, but slightly green nonetheless, manhandled a large cask through the hatchway and onto the deck. The top had been split, and I caught a brief glimpse of a yellowish-white mass in the opening, glistening faintly in the sun. It seemed to be moving. Maggots in profusion.
Ew!
The exclamation was jerked from me involuntarily. The two sailors said nothing, their lips being pressed tightly together, but both of them looked as though they agreed with me. Together they manhandled the cask to the rail and heaved it up and over. Such of the crew as were not otherwise employed gathered at the rail to watch the cask bobbing in the wake, and be entertained by Murphy's outspoken, blasphemous opinion of the ship's chandler, who had sold it to him. Manzetti, a small Italian seaman with a thick russet pigtail, was standing by the rail, loading a musket.
"Shark,"
he explained with a gleam of teeth beneath his moustache, seeing me watching him.
"Very good to eat."
"Arr," said Sturgis approvingly.
Such of the crew as were not presently occupied gathered at the stern, watching. There were sharks, I knew. Maitland had pointed out to me two dark, flexible shapes hovering in the shadow of the hull the evening before, keeping pace with the ship with no apparent effort save a small and steady oscillation of sickled tails.
"There!"
A shout went up from several throats as the cask jerked suddenly in the water. A pause, and Manzetti fixed his aim carefully in the vicinity of the floating cask. Another jerk, as though something had bumped it violently, and another. The water was a muddy grey, but clear enough for me to catch a glimpse of something moving under the surface, fast. Another jerk, the cask heeled to one side, and suddenly the sharp edge of a fin creased the surface of the water, and a grey back showed briefly, tiny waves purling off it. The musket discharged next to me with a small roar and a cloud of black powder smoke that left my eyes stinging. There was a universal shout from the observers, and when the watering of my eyes subsided, I could see a small brownish stain spreading round the cask. "Did he hit the shark or the horse meat?" I asked Jamie in a low-voiced aside.
"The cask," he said with a smile. "Still, it's fine shooting."
Several more shots went wild while the cask began to dance in an agitated jig, the frenzied shark striking it repeatedly. Bits of white and brown flew from the broken cask, and a large circle of grease, rotted blood and debris spread around the shark's feast. As though by magic, seabirds began to appear, one and two at a time, diving for tidbits.
"No good," said Manzetti at last, lowering the musket and wiping his face with his sleeve. "Too far."
He was sweating and stained from neck to hairline with black powder. The wiping left a streak of white across his eyes like a raccoon's mask.
"I could relish a slab of shark," said the captain's voice near my ear.
I turned to see him peering thoughtfully over the rail at the scene of carnage.
"Perhaps we might lower a boat, Mr. Picard."
The boatswain turned with an obliging roar, and the Artemis hauled her wind, coming round in a small circle to draw near the remains of the floating cask. A small boat was launched, containing Manzetti with musket and three seamen armed with gaffs and rope. By the time they reached the spot, there was nothing left of the cask but a few shattered bits of wood. There was still plenty of activity, though. The water roiled with the sharks thrashing beneath the surface, and the scene was nearly obscured by a raucous cloud of seabirds. As I watched, I saw a pointed snout rise suddenly from the water, mouth open, seize one of the birds and disappear beneath the waves, all in the flick of an eyelash.
"Did you see that?" I said, awed.
I was aware, in a general way, that sharks were well equipped with teeth, but this practical demonstration was more striking than any number of National Geographic photographs.
"Why, grandmother dear, what big teeth you have," said Jamie, sounding suitably impressed.
"Ooh, they do indeed,"
said a genial voice nearby. I glanced aside to find Murphy grinning at my elbow, broad face shining with a savage glee.
"Little good it'll do the buggers, with a ball blown clear through their fucking brains."
He pounded a ham-like fist on the rail and shouted,
"Get me one of them jagged buggers, Manzetti. There's a bottle of cooking brandy waiting if you do."
"Is it a personal matter to you, Mr. Murphy?" Jamie asked politely.
"Or professional concern?"
"Both, Mr. Fraser, both,"
the cook replied, watching the hunt with a fierce attention. He kicked his wooden leg against the side with a hollow clunk.
"They've had a taste of me," he said with grim relish, "but I've tasted a good many more of them."
The boat was barely visible through the flapping screen of birds, and their screams made it hard to hear anything other than Murphy's war cries.
"Shark steak with mustard?"
Murphy was bellowing, eyes mere slits in an ecstasy of revenge.
"Stewed liver with piccalilli. I'll make a soup of your fins and jelly your eyeballs and sherry wine, you wicked bastard."
I saw Manzetti, kneeling in the bows, take aim with his musket, and the puff of black smoke as he fired. And then I saw Mr. Willoughby. I hadn't seen him jump from the rail. No one had, with all eyes fixed on the hunt. But there he was, some distance away from the melee surrounding the boat, his shaven head glistening like a fishing float as he wrestled in the water with an enormous bird, its wings churning the water like an egg beater. Alerted by my cry, Jamie tore his eyes from the hunt, goggled for an instant, and before I could move or speak was perched on the rail himself. My shout of horror coincided with a surprised roar from Murphy. But Jamie was gone too, lancing into the water near the Chinaman with barely a splash. There were shouts and cries from the deck, and a shrill screech from Massali as everyone realised what had happened. Jamie's wet red head emerged next to Mr. Willoughby, and in seconds he had an arm tight about the Chinaman's throat. Mr. Willoughby clung tightly to the bird, and I wasn't sure, just for the moment, whether Jamie intended rescue or throttling. But then he kicked strongly and began to tow the struggling mass of bird and man back toward the ship. Triumphant shouts from the boat, and a spreading circle of deep red in the water. There was a tremendous thrashing as one shark was gaffed and hauled behind the small boat by a rope about its tail. Then everything was confusion, as the men in the boat noticed what else was going on in the water nearby. Lines were thrown over one side and then the other, and crewmen rushed back and forth in high excitement, undecided whether to help with rescue or shark. But at last, Jamie and his burdens were hauled in to starboard and dumped dripping on the deck, while the captured shark, several large bites taken out of its body by its hungry companions, was drawn in, still feebly snapping, to port.
"Jesus Christ," Jamie said, chest heaving.
He lay flat on the deck, gasping like a landed fish. "Are you all right?" I knelt beside him and wiped the water off his face with the hem of my skirt. He gave me a lopsided smile and nodded, still gasping.
"Jesus," he said at last, sitting up.
He shook his head and sneezed.
I thought I was eaten, sure. Those fools in the boat started toward us, and there were sharks all around them under the water, biting at the gaffed one.
He tenderly massaged his calves.
"It's nae doubt oversensitive of me, Sassenach, but I've always dreaded the thought of losing a leg. It seems almost worse than being killed outright."
"I'd as soon you didn't do either," I said dryly.
He was beginning to shiver. I pulled off my shawl and wrapped it around his shoulders, then looked about for Mr. Willoughby. The little Chinese, still clinging stubbornly to his prize, a young pelican nearly as big as he was, ignored both Jamie and the considerable abuse flung in his direction. He squelched below, dripping, protected from physical castigation by the clacking bill of his captive, which discouraged anyone from getting too close to him. A nasty chunking sound and a crow of triumph from the other side of the deck announced Murphy's use of an axe to dispatch his erstwhile nemesis. The seamen clustered round the corpse, knives drawn, to get pieces of the skin. Further enthusiastic chopping, and Murphy came strolling past, beaming, a choice selection of tail under his arm, the huge yellow liver hanging from one hand in a bag of netting, and the bloody axe slung over his shoulder.
"Not drowned, are you?" he said, ruffling Jamie's damp hair with his spare hand. "I can't see why you'd bother with a little bugger myself, but I'll say 'twas bravely done. I'll brew you up a fine broth from the tail to keep off the chill," he promised.
And stumped off, planning menus aloud.
"Why did he do it?" I asked. "Mr. Willoughby, I mean."
Jamie shook his head and blew his nose on his shirt tail.
"Damned if I know. He wanted the bird, I expect, but I couldn't see why. To eat, maybe."
Murphy overheard this and swung round at the head of the galley ladder, frowning. "You can't eat pelicans," he said, shaking his head in disapproval. "Fishy tasting, no matter how you cook 'em. And God knows what one's doing out here anyway. They're shorebirds, pelicans. Blown out by a storm, I suppose. Awkward buggers."
His bald head disappeared into his realm, murmuring happily of dried parsley and cayenne. Jamie laughed and stood up.
"Aye, well, perhaps it's only he wants the feathers to make quills of. Come along below, Sassenach. You can help me dry my back."
He had spoken jokingly, but as soon as the words were out of his mouth, his face went blank. He glanced quickly to port, where the crew was arguing and jostling over the remains of the shark, while Fergus and Massali cautiously examined the severed head lying gape-jawed on the deck. Then his eyes met mine with a perfect understanding. 30 seconds later, we were below in his cabin. Cold drops from his wet hair rained over my shoulders and slid down my bosom, but his mouth was hot and urgent. The hard curves of his back glowed warm through the soaked fabric of the shirt that stuck to them.
"Efren," he said breathlessly, breaking loose long enough to yank at his breeches. "Christ, they're stuck to me. I cannot get them off."
Snorting with laughter, he jerked at the laces, but the water had soaked them into a hopeless knot.
"A knife," I said. "Where's a knife?"
Snorting myself at the sight of him struggling frantically to get his drenched shirt tail out of his breeches, I began to rummage through the drawers of the desk, tossing out bits of paper, a bottle of ink, a snuff box, everything but a knife. The closest thing was an ivory letter opener, made in the shape of a hand with a pointing finger. I seized upon this and grasped him by the waistband, trying to saw at the tangled laces. He yelped in alarm and backed away.
"Christ, be careful with that, Sassenach. It's no going to do you any good to get my breeks off, and you geld me in the process."
Half crazed with lust as we were, that seemed funny enough to double us both up, laughing.
"Here."
Rummaging in the chaos of his berth, he snatched up his dirk and brandished it triumphantly. An instant later, the laces were severed, and the sopping breeks lay puddled on the floor. He seized me, picked me up bodily, and laid me on the desk, heedless of crumpled papers and scattered quills. Tossing my skirts up past my waist, he grabbed my hips and half lay on me, his hard thighs forcing my legs apart. It was like grasping a salamander, a blaze of heat in a chilly shroud. I gasped as the tail of his sopping shirt touched my bare belly, then gasped again as I heard footsteps in the passage.
"Stop," I hissed in his ear. "Someone's coming." "Too late," he said, with breathless certainty. "I must have you, or die."
He took me with one quick, ruthless thrust, and I bit his shoulder hard, tasting salt and wet linen, but he made no sound. Two strokes, three, and I had my legs locked tight around his buttocks, my cry muffled in his shirt, not caring either who else might be coming. He had me, quickly and thoroughly, and thrust himself home and home and home again, with a deep sound of triumph in his throat, shuddering and shaking in my arms. 2 minutes later, the cabin door swung open. Innes looked slowly round the wreckage of the room. His soft brown gaze travelled from the ravaged desk to me, sitting damp and dishevelled, but respectably clothed upon the berth, and rested at last on Jamie, who sat collapsed on a stool, still clad in his wet shirt, chest heaving, and the deep red colour fading slowly from his face. Innes's nostrils flared delicately, but he said nothing. He walked into the cabin, nodding at me, and bent to reach under Fergus's berth, whence he pulled out a bottle of brandy wine.
"For the Chinee," he said to me, "so as he mightn't take a chill."
He turned toward the door and paused, squinting thoughtfully at Jamie.
"You might should have Mr. Murphy make you some broth on that same account, MacDo. They do say as 'tis dangerous to get chilled after hard work, aye? You dunno want to take the ague."
There was a faint twinkle in the mournful brown depths. Jamie brushed back the salty tangle of his hair, a slow smile spreading across his face.
"Aye, well, and if it should come to that, Innes, at least I shall die a happy man."
We found out the next day what Mr. Willoughby wanted the pelican for. I found him on the after deck, the bird perched on a sail chest beside him, its wings bound tight to its body by means of strips of cloth. It glared at me with round yellow eyes and clacked its bill in warning. Mr. Willoughby was pulling in a line, on the end of which was a small, wriggling purple squid. Detaching this, he held it up in front of the pelican and said something in Chinese. The bird regarded him with deep suspicion, but didn't move. Quickly, he seized the upper bill in his hand, pulled it up, and tossed the squid into the bird's pouch. The pelican, looking surprised, gulped convulsively and swallowed it.
"Howliow,"
Mr. Willoughby said approvingly, stroking the bird's head. He saw me watching and beckoned me to come closer. Keeping a cautious eye on the wicked bill, I did so.
"Ping An,"
he said, indicating the pelican.
peaceful one.
The bird erected a small crest of white feathers for all the world as though it were pricking up its ears at its name, and I laughed.
Really? What are you going to do with him?
I teach him hunt for me, the little Chinese said matter-of-factly. You watch.
I did. After several more squid and a couple of small fish had been caught and fed to the pelican, Mr. Willoughby removed another strip of soft cloth from the recesses of his costume and wrapped this snugly round the bird's neck.
Not want choke, he explained. Not swallow fish.
He then tied a length of light line tightly to this collar, motioned me to stand back, and with a swift jerk released the bindings that held the bird's wings. Surprised at the sudden freedom, the pelican waddled back and forth on the locker, flapped its huge bony wings once or twice, and then shot into the air in an explosion of feathers. A pelican on the ground is a comical thing, all awkward angles, splayed feet and gawky bill. A soaring pelican, circling over water, is a thing of wonder, graceful and primitive, startling as a pterodactyl among the sleeker forms of gulls and petrels. Ping An, the peaceful one, soared to the limit of his line, struggled to go higher, then, as though resigned, began to circle. Mr. Willoughby, eyes squinted nearly shut against the sun, spun slowly round and round on the deck below, playing the pelican like a kite. All the hands in the rigging and on deck nearby stopped what they were doing to watch in fascination. Sudden as a bolt from a crossbow, the pelican folded its wings and dived, cleaving the water with scarcely a splash. As it popped to the surface, looking mildly surprised, Mr. Willoughby began to tow it in. Aboard once more, the pelican was persuaded, with some difficulty, to give up its catch, but at last suffered its captor to reach cautiously into the leathery, subgular pouch and extract a fine, fat sea bream. Mr. Willoughby smiled pleasantly at a gawking Picard, took out a small knife, and slit the still-living fish down the back. Pinioning the bird in one wiry arm, he loosened the collar with his other hand and offered it a flapping piece of bream, which Ping An eagerly snatched from his fingers and gulped. His, Mr. Willoughby explained, wiping blood and scales carelessly on the leg of his trousers.
Mine,
nodding toward the half-fish, still sitting on the locker, now motionless. Within a week, the pelican was entirely tame, able to fly free, collared, but without the tethering line, returning to his master to regurgitate a pouchful of shining fish at his feet. When not fishing, Ping An either took up a position on the cross-trees, much to the displeasure of the crewman responsible for swabbing the deck beneath, or followed Mr. Willoughby around the deck, waddling absurdly from side to side, 8-foot wings half-spread for balance. The crew, both impressed by the fishing and wary of Ping An's great snapping bill, steered clear of Mr. Willoughby, who made his words each day beside the mast, weather permitting, secure under the benign yellow eye of his new friend. I paused one day to watch Mr. Willoughby at his work, staying out of sight behind the shelter of the mast. He sat for a moment, a look of quiet satisfaction on his face, contemplating the finished page. I couldn't read the characters, of course, but the shape of the whole thing was somehow very pleasing to look at. Then he glanced quickly round, as though checking to see that no one was coming, picked up the brush, and with great care added a final character in the upper left corner of the page. Without asking, I knew it was his signature. He sighed then, and lifted his face to look out over the rail. Not inscrutable by any means, his expression was filled with a dreaming delight, and I knew that whatever he saw, it was neither the ship nor the heaving ocean beyond. At last, he sighed again and shook his head as though to himself. He laid hands on the paper and quickly, gently, folded it once and twice and again. Then, rising to his feet, he went to the rail, extended his hands over the water, and let the folded white shape fall. It tumbled toward the water. Then the wind caught it and whirled it upward a bit of white receding in the distance, looking much like the gulls and terns who squawked behind the ship in search of scraps. Mr. Willoughby didn't stay to watch it, but turned away from the rail and went below, the dream still stamped on his small, round face. Chapter 45. Mr. Willoughby's Tale. As we passed the centre of the Atlantic Gyre and headed south, the days and evenings became warm, and the off-duty crew began to congregate on the forecastle for a time after supper, to sing songs, dance to Brodie Cooper's fiddle, or to listen to stories. With the same instinct that makes children camping in the wood tell ghost stories, the men seemed particularly fond of horrible tales of shipwreck and the perils of the sea. As we passed farther south and out of the realm of kraken and sea serpent, the mood for monsters passed, and the men began instead to tell stories of their homes. It was after most of these had been exhausted that Maitland, the cabin boy, turned to Mr. Willoughby, crouched as usual against the foot of the mast with his cup cradled to his chest. "How was it that you came from China, Willoughby?" Maitland asked curiously. "I've not seen more than a handful of Chinese sailors, though folk do say as there's a great many people in China. Is it such a fine place that the inhabitants don't care to take leave of it, perhaps?" At first demurring, the little Chinese seemed mildly flattered at the interest provoked by this question. With a bit more urging, he consented to tell of his departure from his homeland, requiring only that Jamie should translate for him, his own English being inadequate to the task. Jamie readily agreeing, he sat down beside Mr. Willoughby and cocked his head to listen. "I was a mandarin," Mr. Willoughby began in Jamie's voice. "A mandarin of letters, one gifted in composition. I wore a silk gown, embroidered in very many colours, and over this the scholar's blue silk gown with the badge of my office embroidered upon breast and back. The figure of a Feng Huang, a bird of fire." "I think he means a phoenix," Jamie added, turning to me for a moment before directing his attention back to the patiently waiting Mr. Willoughby, who began speaking again at once. "I was born in Peking, the imperial city of the Son of Heaven." "That is how they call their emperor," Fergus whispered to me. "Such presumption to equate their king with the Lord Jesus." "Shh!" hissed several people, turning indignant faces toward Fergus. He made a rude gesture at Maxwell Gordon, but fell silent, turning back to the small figure sitting crouched against the mast. "I was found early to have some skill in composition, and while I was not at first adept in the use of brush and ink, I learned at last, with great effort, to make the representations of my brush resemble the ideas that danced like cranes within my mind. And so I came to the notice of Wu Zhen, a mandarin of the imperial household, who took me to live with him and oversaw my training. I rose rapidly in merit and eminence, so that before my 26th birthday I had attained a globe of red coral upon my hat. And then came an evil wind that blew the seeds of misfortune into my garden. It may be that I was cursed by an enemy, or perhaps that in my arrogance I had omitted to make proper sacrifice. For surely I was not lacking in reverence to my ancestors, being careful always to visit my family's tomb each year, and to have joss sticks always burning in the Hall of Ancestors. If his compositions were always so long-winded, no doubt the Son of Heaven lost patience and tossed him in the river," Fergus muttered cynically. "But whatever the cause," Jamie's voice continued, "my poetry came before the eyes of Wan Mei, the Emperor's second wife. Second wife was a woman of great power, having borne no less than 4 sons. And when she asked that I might become part of her own household, the request was granted at once." "What was wrong with that?" demanded Gordon, leaning forward in interest. "A chance to get on in the world, surely?" Mr. Willoughby evidently understood the question, for he nodded in Gordon's direction as he continued, and Jamie's voice took up the story. "Oh, the honour was inestimable.
I should have had a large house of my own within the walls of the palace, and a guard of soldiers to escort my palanquin with a triple umbrella borne before me in symbol of my office, and perhaps even a peacock feather for my hat. My name would have been inscribed in letters of gold in the Book of Merit.
The little Chinaman paused, scratching at his scalp. The hair had begun to sprout from the shaved part, making him look rather like a tennis ball.
However, there is a condition of service within the imperial household. All the servants of the royal wives must be eunuchs.
A gasp of horror greeted this, followed by a babble of agitated comment, in which the remarks, "Bloody heathen!" and "Yellow bastards!" were heard to predominate.
"What is a eunuch?" Massali asked, looking bewildered.
"Nothing you need ever concern yourself with, Sherry,"
Fergus assured her, slipping an arm about her shoulders.
"So you're Anne, mon ami,"
he addressed Mr. Willoughby in tones of deepest sympathy.
"I shall do the same, without doubt."
A deep murmur of heartfelt approbation reinforced this sentiment. Mr. Willoughby seemed somewhat heartened by such evident approval. He bobbed his head once or twice at his listeners before resuming his story.
"It was most dishonourable of me to refuse the Emperor's gift. And yet, it is a grievous weakness. I had fallen in love with a woman."
There was a sympathetic sigh at this, most sailors being wildly romantic souls. But Mr. Willoughby stopped, jerking at Jamie's sleeve and saying something to him.
"Oh, I'm wrong," Jamie corrected himself. "He says it was not a woman, just woman. All women, or the idea of women in general, he means. That's it?" he asked, looking down at Mr. Willoughby.
The Chinaman nodded, satisfied, and sat back. The moon was full up by now, three quarters full, and bright enough to show the little mandarin's face as he talked.
"Yes," he said through Jamie. "I thought much of women, their grace and beauty, blooming like lotus flowers, floating like milkweed on the wind, and the myriad sounds of them, sometimes like the chatter of rice birds or the song of nightingales, sometimes the cawing of crows," he added, with a smile that creased his eyes to slits and brought his hearers to laughter. "But even then, I loved them. I wrote all my poems to women. Sometimes they were addressed to one lady or another, but most often to women alone. To the taste of breasts like apricots, the warm scent of a woman's navel when she wakens in the winter, the warmth of a mound that fills your hand like a peach, split with ripeness."
Fergus, scandalised, put his hands over Masali's ears, but the rest of his hearers were most receptive.
"No wonder the wee fellow was an esteemed poet," Rayburn said with approval. "It's very heathen, but I like it."
"Worth a red knob on your hat any day," Maitland agreed.
"Almost worth learning a bit of Chinese for,"
the master's mate chimed in, eyeing Mr. Willoughby with fresh interest.
"Does he have a lot of those poems?"
Jamie waved the audience, by now augmented by most of the off-duty hands, to silence, and said,
"Go on, then," to Mr. Willoughby.
"I fled on the Night of Lanterns," the Chinaman said. "A great festival, and one when people would be thronging the streets. There would be no danger of being noticed by the watchmen. Just after dark, as the processions were assembling throughout the city, I put on the garments of a traveller."
"That's like a pilgrim," Jamie interjected. "They go to visit their ancestors' tombs far away and wear white clothes. That's for mourning, you ken."
"And I left my house. I made my way through the crowds without difficulty, carrying a small anonymous lantern I had bought, one without my name and place of residence painted on it. The watchmen were hammering upon their bamboo drums, the servants of the great households beating gongs, and from the roof of the palace fireworks were being set off in great profusion."
The small round face was marked by nostalgia as he remembered.
"It was, in a way, most appropriate a farewell for a poet," he said, fleeing nameless to the sound of great applause. "As I passed the soldiers' garrison at the city gate,
I looked back to see the many roofs of the palace outlined by bursting flowers of red and gold. It looked like a magic garden, and a forbidden one for me. Yi Cheng Chu had made his way without incident through the night, but had nearly been caught the next day. "I had forgotten my fingernails," he said. He spread out a hand, small and short-fingered, the nails bitten to the quicks. "For a mandarin has long nails, a symbol that he is not obliged to work with his hands. And my own were the length of one of my finger joints." A servant at the house where he had stopped for refreshment next day saw them and ran to tell the guard. Yi Qiang Chou ran too, and succeeded at last in eluding his pursuers by sliding into a wet ditch and lying hidden in the bushes.
"While lying there, I destroyed my nails, of course," he said.
He waggled the little finger of his right hand. "Was obliged to tear that nail out, for it had a golden dajou inlaid in it, which I could not dislodge." He had stolen a peasant's clothes from a bush where they had been hung to dry, leaving the torn-out nail with its golden character in exchange, and made his way slowly across country toward the coast. At first, he paid for his food the small store of money he had brought away, but outside Lulong, he met with a band of robbers who took his money but left him his life.
"And after that," he said simply, "I stole food when I could, and starved when I could not. And at last the wind of fortune changed a little, and I met with a group of travelling apothecaries on their way to the physician's fair near the coast. In return for my skill at drawing banners for their booth and composing labels extolling the virtues of their medicines, they carried me along with them."
Once reaching the coast, he had made his way to the waterfront and tried there to pass himself off as a seaman, but failed utterly, as his fingers, so skilful with brush and ink, knew nothing of the art of knots and lines. There were several foreign ships in port. He had chosen the one whose sailors looked the most barbarous as being likely to carry him farthest away, and seizing his chance, had slipped past the deck guard and into the hold of the Serafina, bound for Edinburgh.
"You had always meant to leave the country altogether?" Fergus asked, interested. "It seems a desperate choice."
"Emperor's reach, very long," Mr. Willoughby said softly in English, not waiting for translation. "I am exile, or I am dead." His listeners gave a collective sigh at the awesome contemplation of such bloodthirsty power, and there was a moment of silence, with only the whine of the rigging overhead, while Mr. Willoughby picked up his neglected cup and drained the last drops of his grog. He set it down, licking his lips, and laid his hand once more on Jamie's arm.
"It is strange,"
Mr. Willoughby said, and the air of reflection in his voice was echoed exactly by Jamie's.
"But it was my joy of women that second wife saw, and loved in my words. Yet by desiring to possess me and my poems, she would have forever destroyed what she admired."
Mr. Willoughby uttered a small chuckle, whose irony was unmistakable.
"Nor is that the end of the contradiction my life has become. Because I could not bring myself to surrender my manhood, I have lost all else, honour, livelihood, country. By that, I mean not only the land itself, with the slopes of noble fir trees where I spent my summers in Tartary, and the great plains of the south, the flowing of rivers filled with fish, but also the loss of myself. My parents are dishonoured, and the tombs of my ancestors fall into ruin, and no joss burns before their images. All order, all beauty is lost. I am come to a place where the golden words of my poems are taken for the clucking of hens, and my brush strokes for their scratchings. I am taken as less than the meanest beggar who swallows serpents for the entertainment of the crowds, allowing passers-by to draw the serpent from my mouth by its tail, for the tiny payment that will let me live another day."
Mr. Willoughby glared round at his hearers, making his parallel evident.
I am come to a country of women, coarse and rank as bears.
The Chinaman's voice rose passionately, though Jamie kept to an even tone, reciting the words, but stripping them of feeling.
They are creatures of no grease, no learning, ignorant, bad-smelling. Their bodies gross with sprouting hair like dogs. And these, disdain me as a yellow worm, so that even the lowest whores will not lie with me. For the love of woman, I am come to a place where no woman is worthy of love.
At this point, seeing the dark looks on the seamen's faces, Jamie ceased translating, and instead tried to calm the Chinaman, laying a big hand on the blue silk shoulder.
"Aye, man, I quite see. And I'm sure there's no a man present would have done otherwise, given the choice. Is that not so, lads?" he asked,
glancing over his shoulder with eyebrows raised significantly. His moral force was sufficient to extort a grudging murmur of agreement, but the crowd's sympathy with the tale of Mr. Willoughby's travails had been quite dissipated by his insulting conclusion. Pointed remarks were made about licentious, ungrateful heathen, and a great many extravagantly admiring compliments paid to Massali and me as the men dispersed aft. Fergus and Massali left then too, Fergus pausing en route to inform Mr. Willoughby that any further remarks about European women would cause him, Fergus, to be obliged to wrap his, Willoughby's, queue about his neck and strangle him with it. Mr. Willoughby ignored remarks and threats alike, merely staring straight ahead, his black eyes shining with memory and grog. Jamie at last stood up too, and held out a hand to help me down from my cask. It was as we were turning to leave that the Chinaman reached down between his legs. Completely without lewdness, he cupped his testicles so that the rounded mass pressed against the silk. He rolled them slowly in the palm of his hand, staring at the bulge in deep meditation.
"Sometime," he said, as though to himself, "I think not worth it."
Chapter 46. We meet a porpoise. I had been conscious for some time that Massali was trying to get up the nerve to speak to me. I had thought she would, sooner or later. Whatever her feelings toward me, I was the only other woman aboard. I did my best to help, smiling kindly and saying, "Good morning," but the first move would have to be hers. She made it, finally, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, a month after we had left Scotland. I was writing in our shared cabin, making surgical notes on a minor amputation, two smashed toes on one of the foredeck hands. I had just completed a drawing of the surgical site when a shadow darkened the doorway of the cabin, and I looked up to see Massali standing there, chin thrust out pugnaciously. "I need to know something," she said firmly. "I dinna like you, and I reckon you ken that. But Da says you're a wise woman, and I think you're maybe an honest woman, even if you are a whore. So you'll maybe tell me." There were any number of possible responses to this remarkable statement, but I refrained from making any of them. "Maybe I will," I said, putting down the pen. "What is it you need to know?" Seeing that I wasn't angry, she slid into the cabin and sat down on the stool, the only available spot. "Well, it's to do with bairns," she explained, "and how you get them." I raised one eyebrow.
"Your mother didn't tell you where babies come from?"
She snorted impatiently, her small blonde brows knotted in fierce scorn.
"Of course I ken where they come from. Any fool knows that much. You let a man put his prick between your legs, and there's the devil to pay 9 months later. What I want to know is how you don't get them."
"I see." I regarded her with considerable interest.
"You don't want a child. Once you're properly married, I mean. Most young women seem to."
"Well," she said slowly, twisting a handful of her dress, "I think I maybe would like a babe sometime. For itself, I mean. If it maybe had dark hair like Fergus." A hint of dreaminess flitted across her face, but then her expression hardened once more. "But I can't," she said.
Why not? She pushed out her lips, thinking, then pulled them in again.
Well, because of Fergus.
We haven't lain together yet. We haven't been able to do more than kiss each other now and again behind the hatch covers. Thanks to Da and his bloody-minded notions, she added bitterly.
Amen, I said, with some wryness.
Eh? Never mind.
I waved a hand, dismissing it.
What has that got to do with not wanting babies?
I want to like it, she said matter-of-factly. When we get to the prick part.
I bit the inside of my lower lip. I imagine that has something to do with Fergus. But I'm afraid I don't quite see what it has to do with babies.
Massali eyed me warily. Without hostility, for once, more as though she were estimating me in some fashion.
Fergus likes you, she said.
I'm fond of him, too, I answered cautiously, not sure where the conversation was heading. I've known him for quite a long time, ever since he was a boy.
She relaxed suddenly, some of the tension going out of the slender shoulders.
Oh, you'll know about it then. Where he was born?
Suddenly I understood her wariness. The brothel in Paris. Yes, I know about that.
He told you then?
She nodded.
Aye, he did. A long time ago, last Hogmanay.
Well, I supposed a year was a long time to a 15-year-old.
That's when I told him I loved him, she went on.
Her eyes were fixed on her skirt, and a faint tinge of pink showed in her cheeks.
And he said he loved me too, but my mother wasn't going to ever agree to the match.
And I said, why not? There was nothing so awful about being French. Not everybody could be Scots. And I didn't think his hand mattered a bit either. After all, there was Mr. Murray with his wooden leg, and Mother liked him well enough. But then he said, no, it was none of those things. And then he told me, about Paris, I mean, and being born in a brothel, and being a pickpocket until he met Da.
She raised her eyes, a look of incredulity in the light blue depths.
I think he thought I'd mind, she said wonderingly. Tried to go away and said he wouldn't see me any more.
Well, she shrugged, tossing her fair hair out of the way. I soon took care of that.
She looked at me straight on then, hands clasped in her lap.
It's just, I didn't want to mention it, in case you didn't know already. But since you do, well, it's no Fergus I'm worried about. He says he knows what to do, and I'll like it fine once we're past the first time or two. But that's not what my mam told me.
What did she tell you? I asked, fascinated.
A small line showed between the light brows.
Well, Massali said slowly, it wasn't so much she said it, though she did say when I told her about Fergus and me that he'd do terrible things to me because of living with whores, and having one for a mother. It was more she acted like it.
Her face was a rosy pink now, and she kept her eyes in her lap where her fingers twisted themselves in the folds of her skirt. The wind seemed to be picking up. Small strands of blonde hair rose gently from her head, wafted by the breeze from the window.
When I started to bleed the first time, she told me what to do, and about how it was part of the curse of Eve, and I must just put up with it. And I said, what was the curse of Eve? And she read me from the Bible all about how St. Paul said women were terrible, filthy sinners because of what Eve did, but they could still be saved by suffering and bearing children.
I never did think a lot of St. Paul, I observed.
And she looked up, startled. But he's in the Bible, she said, shocked.
So are a lot of other things, I said dryly. Heard that story about Gideon and his daughter, have you? Or the fellow who sent his lady out to be raped to death by a crowd of ruffians so that they wouldn't get him? God's chosen men, just like Paul. But go on, do.
She gaped at me for a minute, but then closed her mouth and nodded, a little stunned.
Hey, well, Mother said as how it meant I was nearly old enough to be wed, and when I did marry, I must be sure to remember it was a woman's duty to do as her husband wanted, whether she liked it or no. And she looked so sad when she told me that. I thought, whatever a woman's duty was, it must be awful. And from what St. Paul said about suffering and bearing children. She stopped and sighed. I sat quietly waiting. When she resumed, it was haltingly, as though she had trouble choosing her words. I canna remember my father. I was only 3 when the English took him away. But I was old enough when my mother wed Jamie to see how it was between them. She bit her lip. She wasn't used to calling Jamie by his name. Da, Jamie, I mean. He's kind, I think. He always was to Joan and me. But I'd see when he'd lay his hand on my mother's waist and try to draw her close, she'd shrink away from him. She gnawed her lip some more, then continued. I could see she was afraid. She didn't like him to touch her, but I couldn't see that he ever did anything to be afraid of. Not where we could see. So I thought it must be something he did when they were in their bed alone. Joan and I used to wonder what it could be. Mam never had marks on her face or her arms, and she didn't limp when she walked. Not like Magdalen Wallace, whose husband always beats her when he's drunk on market day. So we didn't think Da hit her. Masali licked her lips, dried by the warm salt air, and I pushed the jug of water toward her. She nodded in thanks and poured a cupful. So I thought, she said, eyes fixed on the stream of water, that it must be because Mam had had children, had us, and she knew it would be terrible again, and so she didn't want to go to bed with Jamie, for fear of it. She took a drink, then set down the cup and looked at me directly, firming her chin in challenge. I saw ye with my da, she said, just that minute before he saw me. I think ye liked what he was doing to you in the bed. I opened my mouth and closed it again. Well, yes, I said, a little weakly. I did. She grunted in satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And you like it when he touches you? I've seen. Well, then, you haven't got any children. And I'd heard that there are ways not to have them, only nobody seems to know just how. But you must, being a wise woman and all. She tilted her head to one side, studying me. I'd like a babe, she admitted. But if it's got to be a babe or liking Fergus, then it's Fergus. So it won't be a babe, if you'll tell me how. I brushed the curls back behind my ear, wondering where on earth to start. Well, I said, drawing a deep breath, to begin with, I have had children. Her eyes sprang wide and round at this. You do? Does Jamie know? Well, of course he does, I replied testily. They were his. I never heard Da had any bairns at all. The pale eyes narrowed with suspicion. I don't imagine he thought it was any of your business, I said, perhaps a trifle more sharply than necessary. And it's not either, I added. But she just raised her brows and went on looking suspicious. The first baby died, I said, capitulating, in France. She's buried there. Our second daughter is grown now. She was born after Culloden. So he's never seen her, the grown one? Masali spoke slowly, frowning. I shook my head, unable to speak for a moment. There seemed to be something stuck in my throat, and I reached for the water. Masali pushed the jug absently in my direction, leaning against the swing of the ship. That's very sad, she said softly to herself. Then she glanced up at me, frowning once more in concentration as she tried to work it all out. So you've had children, and it didn't make a difference to you? Mm-hmm. But it's been a long while then. Did you have other men whilst you were away in France?
Her lower lip came up over the upper one, making her look very much like a small and stubborn bulldog. "That," I said firmly, putting the cup down, "is definitely none of your business. As to whether childbirth makes a difference, possibly it does to some women, but not all of them. But whether it does or not, there are good reasons why you might not want to have a child right away." She withdrew the pouting underlip and sat up straight, interested.
"So there is a way?"
"There are a lot of ways, and unfortunately most of them don't work," I told her, with a pang of regret for my prescription pad and the reliability of contraceptive pills. Still, I remembered well enough the advice of the maîtresse sage femme, the experienced midwives of the Hôpital des Anges, where I had worked in Paris 20 years before. "Hand me the small box in the cupboard over there," I said, pointing to the doors above her head. "Yes, that one." "Some of the French midwives make a tea of bayberry and valerian," I said, rummaging in my medicine box. "But it's rather dangerous, and not all that dependable, I don't think."
"Do you miss her?" Massali asked abruptly.
I glanced up, startled.
"Your daughter?"
Her face was abnormally expressionless, and I suspected the question had more to do with Lyra than with me. "Yes," I said simply. "But she's grown. She has her own life." The lump in my throat was back, and I bent my head over the medicine box, hiding my face. The chances of Lyra ever seeing Massali again were just about as good as the chances that I would ever see Brianna. It wasn't a thought I wanted to dwell on. "Here," I said, pulling out a large chunk of clean sponge. I took one of the thin surgical knives from the fitted slots in the lid of the box and carefully sliced off several thin pieces, about 3 inches square. I searched through the box again and found the small bottle of tansy oil, with which I carefully saturated one square under Masali's fascinated gaze. "All right," I said. "That's about how much oil to use. If you haven't any oil, you can dip the sponge in vinegar. Even wine will work, in a pinch. You put the bit of sponge well up inside you before you go to bed with a man. Mind you do it even the first time. You can get with child from even once." Massali nodded, her eyes wide, and touched the sponge gently with a forefinger.
"Aye, and after? Do I take it out again, or—"
An urgent shout from above, coupled with a sudden heeling of the Artemis as she backed her mainsails, put an abrupt end to the conversation. Something was happening up above. "I'll tell you later," I said, pushing the sponge and bottle toward her, and headed for the passage. Jamie was standing with the captain on the afterdeck, watching the approach of a large ship behind us. She was perhaps 3 times the size of the Artemis, 3-masted, with a perfect forest of rigging and sail, through which small black figures hopped like fleas on a bedsheet. A puff of white smoke floated in her wake, token of a cannon recently fired.
"Is she firing on us?" I asked in amazement.
"No," Jamie said grimly. "A warning shot only. She means to board us."
"Can they?"
I addressed the question to Captain Raines, who was looking even more glum than usual, the downturned corners of his mouth sunk in his beard.
"They can," he said. "We'll not outrun her in a stiff breeze like this on the open sea."
"What is she?"
Her ensign flew at the masthead, but seen against the sun at this distance, it looked completely black. Jamie glanced down at me, expressionless.
"A British man of war, Sassenach. 74 guns. Perhaps you'd best go below."
This was bad news. While Britain was no longer at war with France, relations between the two countries were by no means cordial. And while the Artemis was armed, she had only 4 12-pound guns, sufficient to deter small pirates, but no match for a man of war.
"What can they want of us?" Jamie asked the captain.
Raines shook his head, his soft, plump face set grimly.
"Likely pressing," he answered. "She's short-handed. You can see by her rigging, and her foredeck all a-hoo,"
he noted disapprovingly, eyes fixed on the man of war, now looming as she drew alongside. He glanced at Jamie.
They can press any of our hands who look to be British, which is something like half the crew. And yourself, Mr. Fraser, unless you wish to pass for French.